This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Night Speaker Meeting held at El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120 in San Jose, California, on July 10th, 1992. Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Darcy C., and the main speaker is Bonnie R. The original recording and its copy are at the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not place recording for commercial or entertainment purposes, and please do not break the name of the speakers or any AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Darcy. I'm an alcoholic. They do this for me every time I chair a meeting. I was thinking how I was going to keep this to only 10 minutes because I really like to talk. So I think I'll just basically share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm trying to find something in here, so give me a minute. As you probably guessed, like Ron said, I have 5 years today, and I want to say to the new people that if you're sitting out there and you're wondering how I got 5 years and thinking that you could never do it, I just want you to know that there was a time that I used to sit in meetings and I never thought that I could make it. I never thought that I would make it this long. And it's only by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program that I've made it this long. And my drunk log is pretty boring. I mean, it's more or less probably like everyone else. Although I got sober at 18 years old, so my drinking career was only 6 years. And in those 6 years, I managed to destroy every bit of self-worth that I ever had, any idea of spirituality that I may have had. And anyone that tried to get close to me, I was incapable of having relationships with people, and if anyone loved me, I pretty much ruined that. And by the time I got here, it's not that I didn't want to be alive, and it's not that I didn't want to drink. I really wanted to be able to do all the things that I was doing and feel good about it and be able to drink and act like a lady, and that's what I really wanted. And there's a part in the book, and it's on page 315, but the page isn't numbered, and I read this a lot when I chair meetings because it describes exactly how I was when I got here. And it's called They Stopped in Time, and it says, among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, with hospitals, asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there had been occasional serious episodes, but with many, drinking had been little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost either health, business, family, or friends. Why do men and women like these join AA? The 17 who now tell their experiences, or some stories after this, the 17 who now tell their experiences answer that question. They saw that they had become actual or potential alcoholics, even though no serious harm had yet been done. They realized that repeated lack of drinking control when they really wanted control was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that compulsive alcoholism already had them. The complete ruin would be only a question of time. Seeing this danger, they came to AA. They realized that in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly no sane man would wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Therefore, these 17 AAs and hundreds of thousands like them have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up like this. We didn't wait to hit bottom because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I used to listen to the differences a lot, and I would hear people talk about going to jail and having DUIs and losing their kids and getting divorced and doing all this stuff, and I had never done that. I had never been married. I never had anything to lose. I never had a job to lose. And I thought, you know, and I never shot dope, so I thought that I didn't belong there, that I wasn't bad enough, and, like, maybe I hadn't hit bottom yet. And after sticking around a while and listening, I found out that at one time or another, every single person in this room, whether you've been in the gutter or if you just stayed in your house and drank alone, you drank like I did at one time or another. And I really had to listen to that, Instead of looking at how someone had lived in the streets or whatever they had done, I really had to open my ears to hear that at one time they were 18 years old and they were doing what I was doing, and it just got worse. And thank God I stopped before that happened to me. And just because I didn't do all that stuff doesn't mean that I'm not an alcoholic. And the reason that I believe today that I'm an alcoholic is because as soon as I put a drink in my body, I had no control over how much more I was going to put in my body, how much alcohol I was going to consume, and what I was going to do. And that's an alcoholic. That's insane. And so I got here, and I think that God kept me here, and I try to think about what it was like when I was new and stuff, and I just remember bits and pieces. And like I said, I really didn't come here to stop drinking. I really came here to learn how to drink like a lady. And I look back and I don't know why I stayed. You know, it was like I went through this rehab and I got out, and they told me to go to meetings, and I went to meetings, and I don't know why. And they told me to reach out, and I refused to do that. I would sit there with my arms crossed with this horrible look on my face, and no one would approach me. And it took me, they talk about sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and I think that I was one of the slowly people. I think it took me about 5 months to actually get a sponsor. And then when I did, it took me a long time to do the steps. And so I'm going to skip over some time here, because if I told you about every single year of my sobriety, I would be up here for a long time. But my life today is so incredible, and I wish, it's like I wish that I could give it to a new person on a silver platter and just say, here it is, this is it, you can have it. But everyone has to work for their own thing in this program, you know. I have worked very, very hard to have what I have today. And I certainly don't take, it's not a pride thing. I have God in my life, and I know that that's the only reason that I'm even alive and that I have anything. But this program takes footwork, and they talk about it being simple, and it is really simple, but it's not easy. It's not, when I got here, it wasn't easy for me to give up the friends that I was hanging out with, because they were as sick as I was, and I had to get away from that, and that was not easy for me. Sharing myself with someone else was not easy for me. Telling someone all of my deep, dark secrets was not easy for me. Looking at myself wasn't easy. Trying to get a God in my life wasn't easy, but I did it, you know? I just kept walking. I just kept doing it, and now I've been here 5 years, and it totally blows my mind. And I have to share that last year at this time, I had 4 years, and I, that was hard to figure out, huh? I don't know why I said that, but I had 4 years, and my life was really falling apart, and I didn't know if I was going to stay sober. And I had a marriage that I had been planning for a year that didn't happen. I hadn't been working a program for a year, at least. I was like barely going to meetings, and the thought of praying like really made me sick, because I didn't think God was going to take care of me. And I turned 4, and I ended up checking myself into a hospital. Well, not a hospital, but a program to try to get some help. And I thought all this stuff was going to happen. I thought, well, first of all, I thought when I ended my relationship with my fiance that I was going to get into the program again, and I was going to get better. And he left, and I didn't get better, and I didn't go to meetings, and I didn't do anything. And then I thought, well, I'll just check myself into this place, and I'll get better. They'll, like, help me, and I'll get out, and I'll have this new enthusiasm for life, and just want to put myself out there and get back into AA. And I got out, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to stay home and really wallow in my misery. And I did. And I did for almost a year. And the last 3 months or so, I say 3 months, I don't really know how long it's been. It's been around that long. My life has changed dramatically. I have, somebody told me that 5 years is a time for recommitment, and I never bought that stuff. I always thought that it was a bunch of crap, that, you know, this year was for this and this year was for this. But 5 years for me has been a time of recommitment, and I have completely recommitted myself to this program. And while it's a lot different than it was when I was new, I mean, I want different things than I wanted when I was new. The steps and helping others and doing all that stuff that they talk about is working for me. And if that's, you know, I try to think of, like, some totally profound thing that I could share that would, like, make everyone think that they want to stay here. But the only thing that I can share with you is that it works, and it's worked for me for this long. And I'm just really amazed that I'm here, and I'm really grateful that I was asked to speak and that you guys listened to me, and I'm going to shut up and sit down. So thank you.
My name is Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know, it never gets old when I say that. My name is Bonnie, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know about you, but I never knew I was an alcoholic before I got here. I've had the privilege of being a sober member of this fellowship since May 29th, 1979. And as far as I'm concerned, my life began May 29th, 1979. And the 43 years of existence prior to that was a prelude in despair. By way of background, I was born June 3rd, 1936 at Children's Hospital in San Francisco. At birth, I suffered cardiac arrest and respiratory arrest, and the cord was wrapped around my neck 3 times and I was left to die. And from then on, my life was all downhill. I was not wanted and I was not loved, and my mother was unsuccessful in aborting me. And that's not exactly a winning attitude to bring into life. You know what I mean? I grew up in Los Gatos in Santa Clara, and at age 3, I ran away from home for the first time, and I was so angry when the policeman found this little 3-year-old walking in the weeds of the Los Gatos Creek, and he said, "Bonnie, it's time to go home." And I didn't want to go home. 3 years old, ladies and gentlemen. When I was 5, our family moved to Santa Clara, and I had my first taste of the drug alcohol. Little kid reaching into the refrigerator, and it was a hot day like today, and I got some of my father's beer. And I can remember right now what it was like going down. Indescribable. Indescribable. When I was in the 3rd grade, I had a brother take me out in the garage and sexually molest me, and a week later he went into the priesthood, and I didn't talk about that for 40 years. I had 5 older brothers, and I had a sister, and my sister was born after my mother had 5 sons, and she was born on my mother's birthday, and the role I played in my family was that of the afterbirth. My sister was a model. She was beautiful. She was it for the family. And here I came along. I thought my name was Dan Bratt till I was 10. You know what I mean? Who are you? I live here. No. Yeah, I'm the youngest. What was your name? When I'm in 8th grade, 4 of my 5 brothers are here in Los Gatos studying to be Jesuit priests. And you know what? I didn't stand a chance. I was about 2 in Los Gatos, and I looked around and I figured it out. There's nobody there for the kid. There is nobody out there for me. And I got to make it in this world. And I don't know how to do it, but I'm not going to talk or feel. You know what I mean? And whatever went on from age 2 on stayed inside. And I have dimples, I smile a lot, and I had this charming personality, all that kind of stuff. And I was dead inside. I went to St. Clair's Grammar School, I went to Notre Dame High School in San Jose, I was like student body president and all this kind of stuff. It didn't matter. When When I was 18, I ran away from home. My parents helped me pack, you know. Thank God the kid's gone. I went to the big city. I wanted to be a doctor. I became a nurse. I was going to marry a doctor. I went in the convent. I vowed my life to God forever, and I left. Age 35. A failure. The one thing in life I wanted. I vowed my life to God. I failed. In the 10 years I was in the convent, I had a few problems, you know. I seen a shrink every week. You know when you see the shrink and is anybody home? Nope. Where are you? I don't know, man, but I ain't telling you. Try. So I'm on Thorazine and Elavil and Melaril. You know, that flattened faces and saliva. I'm teaching nursing at the University of San Francisco. The nun. You know what I mean? Standing in front of a class of 300 student nurses, you know, with the shuffle. Saliva. Jesus. I didn't know what was the matter with me. I wasn't drinking. And so I ended the one thing I vowed my life to. And I couldn't live, and I couldn't die, and I moved to Livermore. You know? I don't know what that means. Well, obviously people here know Livermore. The rodeo once a year. Vinucci's Bar. And because my sister lived there, and I stayed with her, and one night she says to me, Bonnie, you want a drink of VO and water? And I said, yes. I took that VO and water, and you know what happened? That little five-year-old and my relation, connection with alcohol, the VO and water stopped the pain. You know, some of us are born, and there's something missing. And 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, for 43 years, that hurt. Inside of me. I don't know about you, but it never went anywhere. That VO and water put out the fire. And you know something? I thought, I have found it. I am going to drink as much as I want to. And for 7 years, ladies and gentlemen, I did that. And I don't know about you, but it is a full-time job being a drunk. You damn addicts, I don't know where you had the time if you drank too. How did you know what you were taking, you know? Alcohol was fine, thank you very much. Don't mess with me while I'm drinking. You know what I mean? Nothing got in the way of my drinking. I didn't socialize, I didn't bar drink, I drank to survive. That's why I drink. Fully expecting, why am I still alive? Who cares? I certainly didn't. And I don't know about you, but when you're drinking and doing a variety of things, you go a variety of places and you do a variety of things. Who cares? I had a license as a nurse, a registered nurse, so I worked in a uniform at places. I eventually wound up back here in San Jose, and I was staying with a brother, and he had a room in the back of his home that was a little bigger than a doghouse. And I was sleeping in that room. And I was going to work as a public health nurse out at Agnew. And I was drinking a fifth of vodka every day and a gallon on the weekends. And as would happen, I had my first DUI. Blood alcohol was 0.26. I'm driven in this little police car out to Elmwood by the sea. I was not in a blackout. And I was stripped and I had every orifice checked. And the little yellow suit and the fingerprints and the mug shot. And that sensation of, I can't put it into words, but you know what I mean. That horrible, horrible feeling. What is the matter with me? I did not yet know I had the disease of alcoholism. And I left that experience. And I had a probation officer, and I had to go once a week to these classes, and they would have a film, what happens when alcohol, metal, and flesh combine. I got very thirsty. I went home and drank. You know, like, those are terrible things that happen to people. 3 months later, my blood alcohol is 0.28. And 3 months later, I'm back at Elmwood. And this time, I really didn't care. Move in the family pictures. Who gives a shit? You know, that piteous, incomparable demoralization, piteous, whatever. You know what I mean. Shitty. Short version. And I'm out there and I go through the repeat of every orifice checked and I'm not in a blackout. I don't know about you. I was not insensitive when I was drunk. I wish I was. My senses were heightened. And I would be around family. And you know families. And they sit there and they're looking at me with pure disgust. Like, what is she going to do next? And all I could do is drink. So I'm out there, and now 0.28 blood alcohol, and the fingerprints, and the mugshot, and urinating in the toilet with people walking around. The nun. You know? And I'm laying in this holding cell, that concrete gray slab, with those wonderful, filthy brown army blanket on top of me. How do you describe how every cell in your body feels? But you've all been there just like I have. How do you describe that? I can't. And laying next to me, there was a woman, and she said, "And what are you in for, honey?" And I said, "Drinking. What are you in for?" And she said, "Prostitution." And that was the first prostitute I met in my life. And at that moment in time, ladies and gentlemen, I had one priest brother that was president of Santa Clara University, and I had another priest brother that was pastor of St. Clair's Church in Santa Clara, where I grew up. And to this day, these two men do not know I was in jail, but you know. And I laid there, and I had what you later taught me here, because whatever I'm talking to you about now, I've learned in these rooms. You have been my teachers. And laying there, I had that experience, and you told me it's that called that moment of truth. And I had that moment of my entire life in review. What happened to me? What is the matter with me? And I could not answer that question. I left that experience, and it took 8 more months of drinking before I got here. In those 8 months, I married somebody for one day. Who are you, you know? Then I married somebody else for 4 months. Ah, you know, E.T., well, who cares? I'd have gone to the moon, Rob Ben. I didn't care that I didn't do worse than what I did. It's not because of me. And when this 4-month event ended, when we went to Reno, and I'd wake up, and I don't know, for those 4 months, I was never sober, but it was like out of body. I was looking down on my life and saying, what is going on? What is going on? And all I could do was drink. And this guy, why don't you just have 2 drinks? What a hell of a question to an alcoholic. I couldn't answer that. I didn't know why I couldn't just have 2 drinks, but I never did. Why bother? 2 drinks of water? Yeah, 2 drinks? It's unthinkable. So the last evening, this man and I were together, he hit me, and it's the only time as an adult I was hit. He blackened my eye, broke my nose and jaw. That got my attention, like, I think there's a problem in my life. Being the intelligent Jesuit-trained agnostic that I was, the nurse and the counselor, I think I should do something about this. So I was teaching a nursing class with a nurse whose husband was head shrinko at Kaiser Santa Clara. So she got me an appointment to see shrinko, you know. And I don't know about you, but I've had lots of experience with shrinkos. So I go, and you know... I love doing this because you go into the shrink's office and they hand you a form. They ask you these simple questions, like your name. Why? Then the date. Is there a newspaper around? And then, why are you here? Let's see. Where am I? And then it's like little checks. Neurotic. You get it. Depressed. Mm-hmm. Schizophrenic. Always wanted to be. Didn't you? They have more damn fun. They're out there having fun. We get out there and we're guilty and we come back. Drives me nuts. They're just staying out there saying, to hell with it. And then it says other, mm-hmm. And then drink a little. I mean, you know, I have to concede here. A little. Two drinks, a beer on the weekend. You know, and so I finished this lie. And you know, you go inside to see the shrink. And I don't know about you, but, you know, a fifth of vodka every day and a gallon on the weekends with a little orange juice, I had the complexion of an orange rind. You know what I mean? And you don't walk, you slosh up. I'm walking in to see the shrink. You know, I kind of... And how the hell did he know this man? First thing he says, would you be willing to try an abuse? Why? And the part of me that age 5 took the first drink of alcohol, and the part of me at age 35 that took that veal and water, and the part of me that for 7 years drank said yes. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I took antabuse for 3 months and I saw shrinky poo every week. I didn't drink. I went through the DTs, hallucinations, diarrhea, gastritis, and I went to work every day as a public health nurse. I still did not know I had the disease of alcoholism. After 3 months, for some unknown reason, nothing in particular, nothing catastrophic, I weaned myself off of antabuse, and I had my last experience with the drug alcohol on this Friday night before Memorial Day of May 1979. I went out and I got a fifth of Ancient Age and a little bottle of Coke. And sitting in front of my television set, whether it was on or off, I can hardly remember, you know. With the drapes drawn, I had half a bottle of Ancient Age and a little Coke. And the next day, by what you taught me here, coincidence, I was invited over to some friends for a barbecue. And the next day, I took that half a bottle of Ancient Age and very ceremoniously took it out near the garbage dumpster and I left it there. I will not waste alcohol, will you? Somebody must have needed it, you know what I mean? And I went over to these friends, hungover, confused, baffled, and this guy's out here barbecuing steaks and nausea is undulating up and down my vein. I'm green and sweating. I'm so miserable. And this man says to me, would you like to go to an AA meeting? I knew nothing about you. Nothing. And I said, yes. He goes up in the next room and he calls up this lady and says, my God, I have this ex-nun. What'll I do with her? Homicide, you know, a lot of people think of homicide when they think of nuns. I used to. Anyway, that Tuesday night, May 29th, 1979, this man picked me up. And he took me to Leon Moore Park for the Tuesday night non-smoking meeting. And this lady right here was there at that meeting, Marlene. And this woman came who had 30 years of sobriety, and she brought her husband who had 30 years of sobriety, and they brought a sister who had 12 years of sobriety to meet this alcoholic. You know how long it's been since I went anywhere? I didn't even have a phone. And I'm there, and this guy just kind of drops, I mean, it's only 12-step call. And he'd be part of the woodwork if I haven't seen him in years. And so this is Mary and Ed Gladwin, and this is Sister Janet, and I, how do you do? And we walk into the meeting, and there was about 35 people there. You know how in the beginning, and they say, "Are there any newcomers?" And I stood up, and I said to you, "My name is Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been free ever since. My name is Bonnie. I'm an alcoholic. I finally found out what was the matter with me." And you said, "Hi, Bonnie." I just, you know, we get this famous eye contact. It's old dead eye. You know, I had a family that would talk to my forehead. "You know, we love you. We'd do anything to help you." Thank you. And they come to AA and they say, "How the hell are you? You know, try. You told me the eyes are the window to the soul. And that night you looked at me, and Marlene looked at me, and you touched something that nobody ever did. My soul. It was like a feather touching my heart." And the woman chaired the meeting that night, and she told me the damnedest thing. She said, "I didn't have to drink anymore if I didn't want to." She had 30 years, what the hell does she know, you know? "What do you mean I don't have to drink anymore if I don't want to? What am I going to do now? My life failed. Now you're telling me I don't have to drink? I know it doesn't work. I know I went to jail twice."
"You don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to."
"Fine." "I might as well stop breathing." And, you know, not that I was intimidated with the 30 years of sobriety. I don't have to drink. "Fine." Then, you know, people say the damnest things in AA, like, "You don't drink, you can't get drunk." I know that. "It's the first drink that'll get you drunk." Well, maybe you, but not me. I had to have at least a fit. You wishy-washy something? One drink for you? This was all in my head, of course. You're sitting there scared to death. How can you tell a newcomer? And the lady told me something else that night. She said that I had a disease. That physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, people like us in these rooms are different than people out there. And I got it. And 5 days later, I wanted to go see a priest, non-Jesuit, because not only was I related to him, I drank with him a lot. Good booze in Jesuit places, let me tell you. Free. And so I went to see a priest in San Francisco that was a diocesan priest. He was chaplain at St. John's at UC San Francisco on Parnassus. And I went to this man's apartment, a very busy man. But he was there, and sitting on this man's couch this Saturday morning, under the seal of confession, this priest described to me his feelings as an alcoholic. And he leaned over, and he touched my hand, and he said, "Bonnie, you're not a sinner, you have a disease just like I do." That was the first human being I related to. I just sat there crying. I'm not a sinner. I'm not bad. I'm not weak-willed. I'm not a loser. I'm an alcoholic. And tears just came down. And he said Mass, and then as I'm walking out the back of the chapel, I says, "And you know, and Mary, you know this lady with the third," I said, "Mary's my sponsor." And she said, "Well, she's a nudist." What? "For God's sake, don't tell her I told you." She did. This lady that saved my life, her background, she was a communist, atheist, nudist. Lived down in Lupin Lodge. And we have a meeting down there now called the Naked Truth. I helped start it. They think I'm kidding, Marlene. She was there too. Some nun had a resentment against another nun, and we had the first meeting of the Naked Truth down there 12 years ago. Anyway, It took 3 months of talking on the phone with the sponsor, and she didn't know that I knew, you know, and all this. I know. And finally, she found out, and she felt Marlene. And I says, I can't tell you who told me. He told me, I was told not to tell you who told me that you're a nudist. And she kept thinking it was Marlene. And for a year, finally after a year, I said, you thought it was Marlene, didn't you? She said, yeah. It wasn't. It was Father Bernie. Which it was. You know, we learned to tell the truth here. Nobody believes us. You taught me that recovery is essentially contained within the 12 steps. You've modeled for me that it's preferable to have a spiritual awakening without the dry heaves, although somebody is going to do that someday. So you've told me that really the basis and foundation of my recovery seems to be not drinking. Heavy, isn't it? What do I owe a little over 13 years of sobriety to? Not drinking one day at a time. Not taking that first drink. You told me, and this little gal talked about it. This is a simple program. Uh-huh. Well, yeah, uh-huh. Change or die. Well, what do I change? Well, how do you think feeling that? Ah, no problem. I'm really sincere. And my sponsor said, you're sincerely wrong. You know what I mean? And at my third meeting, and I asked this lady to be my sponsor, and she says, I am. I got very suspicious of you. I still am. And so from that day until now, I've gone to a meeting practically every day because I want to learn what it is to be an alcoholic. And you teach me every meeting I come to. You teach me about my disease of alcoholism. That if I don't come to a meeting, I won't learn about it. And I don't want to drink, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to drink anymore. Alcohol kicked my ass. It won, I lost. I got that. Really, really clear. You know what I mean? It wins, I lose. And for those that are wondering or cards or conjecturing or thinking about it, you get here and you come to one meeting and it ruins your drinking. You get a little awareness of this stuff, and all of a sudden you can't drink the same way anymore. Pisses me off. Because there have been times in these years where I'd love to have a drink. A bathtub full of bourbon, I'll get to a meeting tomorrow. You know what I mean? Just today. I'll just drink today. I'll go to a meeting tomorrow. But you know, that part says, it doesn't work. And I have not the ability not to drink. I have the ability to lie, cheat, con, and drink. And I haven't done that for a little over 13 years. And this is a gift. A gift called sobriety. And I have done everything for 13 and a half years. You have suggested to me. I have never said no to Alcoholics Anonymous because you have never said no to me. And I'd like to talk now about the second step that says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And by now, Marlene had become my second sponsor. And I believe in the 12 steps. And it says I could be restored to sanity. That must mean I'm insane. And you taught me that insanity is not a psychiatric term. It's a legal term. And sanity has something to do with harmony and balance and something inside my mind, and that I can think clearly and be rational and all that. Well, I've never done that. I don't know about you, but this thing up here was always, it was like my finger in a socket. And yet I managed to get through college and graduate school and never learned anything but this thing. And so, based on the fact that this woman loved me unconditionally and opened up her heart and her home to me, she reached through. You know, we get here and we have armor, you know, out to Saratoga Avenue. Nothing's getting inside of me. No, thank you very much. I've been hurt. And her love went through, and it just needs a little crack. And we go to meetings, and she taught me how to laugh, and she taught me how to have fun, and how to enjoy a meal. And it reached through to me. And she said, you know, Bonnie, you don't have to suffer anymore. Well, hell, she was a Baptist. We Catholics suffer. I was going to help her understand that. And then I get, like, get off the cross from need to wood. That's very offensive. She was a Baptist, so, you know, they're different. So I got it. Finally, I'm a child of God. So I went off to Aptos this one Saturday, and I walked along the beach. And you know when your feet can feel it squiggling on the warm sand. I could feel the sun on my skin for the first time. The warmth of the sun. I could smell the mist of the ocean. And hey, I'm a child of the universe. I didn't know that. And I came back and I was, went to Mass that evening, and the priest in the pulpit says, "And what did you do to nail Jesus to the cross today?" Nothing. So how are you talking? No, I got angry. I got angry and I went home and said, "They're not two gods. Something is the matter here. I will not give up this loving God that I just got to know." And if you don't think that wasn't easy, 44 years as a Catholic, to say, "Screw it." Well, I didn't say that, but I mean, I was going to abandon. And at the time, I didn't know it was my thinking. I didn't know it was my understanding of God, that it was my concept of God. I wasn't that well yet. But the next day, by coincidence, I had a niece who was being confirmed in a cathedral up in the city, and the new Archbishop of San Francisco presided, and he gave a homily on the loving kindness of God. And inside my heart, I said, "My God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would serve of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life." And something connected in my heart. And 4 years later, when I experienced that second, and you talk about the 5 years, something happens. And I was shattered and destroyed, an emotional basket case, despair, depression, you name it. And by now I had a third sponsor, and I went down to a Sycamore for a woman's AA retreat. And I couldn't even participate in the retreat. I was sitting in my room, and my roommate brought my meals, and this Saturday night she says to me, "Come here, you're going to do the third step the way the big book says." And kneeling out in the midnight starlight with the ocean, I said out loud that third step prayer. And I was anchored into a state of peace that has never left me. And the power of that moment was more meaningful than when I was prostrate in a cathedral vowing my life to God, ladies and gentlemen, because that was a commitment I made to be a human being. I have done innumerable fourth and fifth steps. I have spent 8 years in therapy to deal with the fact that my mother tried to abort me, that I was battered and beaten in my crib, that I was sexually molested in my crib by my mother, and that I was molested by a brother who went to become a priest. And I can talk about that flippantly, but to heal from that experiences, I have had the blessing of a sponsor, not only four sponsors, but a therapist who went and led me through it to teach me what you teach me here. I am responsible. I thought that was a dirty word. What do you mean I'm responsible? I am a victim. I am a martyr because my father is an Irish Catholic drunk and my mother is Jewish, and I am guilty. You know what I mean? I have guilt genetically. I'd like a transplant, please. Thank you. This fourth and fifth step have allowed me to share what I never said to anyone from age two on. And I don't have any secrets today. And you have modeled and loved me every single day. And you can feel it in a room right now, the unconditional love. It's been at every AA meeting I have ever gone to. And if I were to say is one thing that which has allowed me not to drink one day at a time has been the unconditional love here. I I never found it in a convent. I never found it in a church. And I'm not saying it isn't there. I found it here. The sixth step says, entirely ready to have God remove every defect of character. And by the time I got some understanding and comprehension of that step, I realized that Hitler was alive and well inside of me. And you give me the right set of circumstances, I'll rip your eye out. Know what I mean? You get in my way, brother, and you're dead meat. And I used to hate that part of me, and you told me, have compassion on that part of me. You told me, that's the anguished part of me crying out to be healed and to be loved by me. You know, there's a big difference between saying, I'm a child of God, and I'm a beloved child of God. Do you know what it's like to know you are beloved? It's a whole different ballgame. I don't come from being defensive. I don't come from justifying. I don't come from having to use power. I come from one child of God talking to another one. I'm looking at the God of my understanding every time I come to a meeting. I look in your eyes. I see God. I see the love. I never saw it before. In step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed. That was my hit list, you know. I'm going to forgive everybody, but my family, men, women, and the Catholic Church. I love dogs, you know? And then you get these damn fool sponsors who say to you, those are the people first to whom you owe amends. Oh, yeah? Step 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. As the years have gone by, I've come to realize from step 8 and step 9 that forgiveness takes place when there's nothing left to forgive. When I was a year and a half sober, I made amends to this religious community I was a member of in Burlingame. And how do you make amends to a community of nuns where you lived for 10 years and you were neurotic and depressed and just a mess? And they had really loved me. And I didn't drink as a nun, ladies and gentlemen. But I had the disease. And you taught me, you go back and you make amends. And the simplicity of it, the nun that was in charge of the order and her assistant were the two nuns that saw me leave the order as I described to you with that flattened faces and the shakes. And I went to them and I said, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in recovery, and one of my steps says I should come and say, I'm sorry if I caused any scandal when I was a nun. And the sister touched my arm, and she says, but Bonnie, you didn't cause any scandal. And I looked at her, and I said, but sister, I didn't know. So then she says, now, where did you go for treatment? I said, I just went to AA. You just went to AA? I said, yes, and if you want to meet my sponsor, she's a communist atheist nudist. They're still praying for me. I said, we have a meeting down there called the Naked Truth, and one of the nuns was there, and we started. You want to come? Oh, God. Pays to be honest. Made a list. The person I hated most in my life was my mother. The person from whom I experienced the most suffering and misunderstanding was my mother. And I don't know about you guys, but we get to AA and there's a couple of things that tweak us out. One of them is God, the word God. The other one is mother. You want to add something else, and, you know, we're not supposed to that word. And so, my mother has been around forever, you know what I mean? And this lady, every couple of years, would say, how's your mother? And I spent a number of years in therapy, and the little kid inside is healed, you know. Obviously, you can see my little child. I've never grown up yet, and I had one sponsor tell me there's a difference between childlike and childish. I said, what? And as the inner child healed, and I started to experience loving myself And eventually my mother wound up back in this area a couple of years ago, and she was 93 years old. And it was finally my turn to help her, because she had estranged herself from everyone else in the family. She had a very, very, very unhappy life. So my turn came, and as it would, I one day took my mother to meet my therapist. And I get my mother there, and I says, "Bernice, this is my mother." "Mm-hmm, yeah." And then she's talking nice to my mother, and she's sweet. And then she looks at me and says, "Bonnie, don't you want to say something to your mother?" Like, I like to kill her, you know. "Oh, no." And so she's talking some more to my mother, and then she looks at me, you know, as only a therapist can look at you, and say, "You sure?" So inside I surrendered, and I looked at my mother, and I said to this woman, "Why have you always hated me? Why have you lied to me? And why did you try to abort me?" And she looked at my therapist, and she said, "I'm sorry." And my therapist says, "Why don't you tell Bonnie that?" And so she looked at me, and she said, "I'm sorry." And I looked this woman in the eyes, and I said, "Mother, I'm not responsible for you, and you're not responsible for me." And she's in my arms, crying. That's all I needed. 2 years ago, last April, this woman died in my arms at peace. In her last 4 months of illness and dying, I was there. A little sit here. And when she went through surgery in O'Connor Hospital a couple of times, I was there in ICU and talking to her and saying, "You were a wonderful mother. You were a perfect wife." And the little girl of her, I got reunited with her mother and father, and her father was murdered when she was 8 years old. As she died, the little kid of her healed. And when she's dying in my arms, I said to her, "Mother, you will not see. My sister was her favorite. She didn't see my sister before she died, nor one of my priest brothers who was her favorite." And when I said to her, "Mother, you're not going to see Anne before you die. You have permission to die." And I said the third step prayer on behalf of every one of my brothers and my sister. And tears came down. And I finally said, "Mother, you have permission to die." And she simply stopped breathing. This is what you gave me. And after she died, I said, "Mom, you're going to have a hell of a send-off, because if you have Jesuit, but the whole church in St. Clair's, I mean, it was wonderful. I was at peace. I arranged the funeral. I got the dress for her." That's freedom, ladies and gentlemen. That's freedom. Step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Now, that's heavy-duty shit, you know, prayer. I mean, go see Sister Act. It's wonderful. Anyway, you would think I had a little experience with prayer and meditation, having been a nun for 10 years. And I always thought I was a contemplative and that I could be out there. But yeah, I was out there, but you were all out there. You know, I don't want to be here. It was like, you know, in the second grade, if you would go to school, and this was the day, today's the day, everybody gets it. And I was home with the flu. And you go back the next day, everybody else got it except me. And all my life, you got it, and you got it, and you got it, and you... I didn't get it. What? I don't know, but I didn't get it. You know what I mean? So I would stay out there. It's fun. And I get here, and they say, no, no. You get inside your body. You stay inside your body. Why? So prayer and meditation, I had some experience with practicing it. I knew nothing about it, you know. So... and when I'm a year and a half or 2 years sober, I wanted to learn more about meditation. And in my opinion, step 11 separates the men from the boys. Step 11, when you're willing to stop and look inside your own heart to find out what's there. Step 11, where you're willing to look behind your eyeballs to see who's there and to love that person And so I meditate every day for an hour, and I go inside. And sometimes it's Mickey Mouse. Other times it's Donald Duck. And other times it's a resentment I had since I was 3, or the grocery list, or the bills I haven't paid. And sometimes it's bliss. Well, as I was learning the proper techniques for meditation, and it's a very disciplined thing to, imagine, turn your brain off without shooting it. You know, you want to take your head off at night and say, "Stay here! I'll put you back on when I want you." And so I was learning in the power of breath and all of this. So I was going away to learn these practices. And this one particular Sunday morning, I got up real early, and I was all set to go practice and learn how to meditate with others. And there's all this kind of energy, and it's a wonderful experience to touch your own inner love, to feel a feather, touch your own heart with your own love. That's what that's about. So this one morning I couldn't, my car wouldn't start, so I said, okay, I'll meditate in my apartment. And I had, you know, the incense and the picture and the candle, and I'm sitting there because I'm all geared up, and it's 5:30 in the morning on Sunday, and it is quiet. And I'm sitting there, and I'm practicing all these things I've learned. And you sit there, and your body's relaxed, and you know, and I'm out in the solar winds. I thought, hey, I go for this. It's so quiet. There's a warm, moist deposit in this hand. And wafting up to my nostrils was the smell of dog poo-poo. I had a dog who shit in my hand. It's it. Here. Never happened to me in the convent. At least not that kind of shit. So, you know, you get really grounded. You know what I mean? Dog shit is very centering. That looketh like dog shit. It's brown. It's cold now. I'm laughing, you know. Laughing so hard. I go and I wash my hands. And I had this dog for 12 years. You know, and if you have a pet or something and we talk weird to our pets, I'm going to ask the dog why he shit in my hand. And I mean, I'm a graduate of USF. So I'm laughing, right? I said, JJ, the dog's here. Come here, come here. I said, as if I'm looking around for something. Why did you do that? And he had a smile on his face. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to go to the great reality deep within. You know, you told me here in this program, you go to the great reality deep within for answers to these heavy questions. My dog's carrying a message, obvious to me. So I'm sitting there trying not to laugh. And I said, okay, God, lay it on me. What's your message? And like my words, it's, Bonnie, you're full of shit. Well, I have never taken God seriously since then, and he hasn't taken me seriously. And you know what? We get along fine. And you know what? When I laugh, I'm not going to drink. That's what you taught me. And when I laugh, I'm as close to God as I ever want to get. When I'm lighthearted, I'm free. And in the magnificence of step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not as the result of going to church, not as the result of sitting at the ocean, not as the result of staring at my navel, as the result of these 12 steps. I don't drink today. And that impresses me. No, Aunt, you asked me here to talk tonight. That impresses me. That somebody wants to hear what I'd have to say. And that you're listening. And that we're at one in this room right now. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. carry the message to the suffering alcoholic? I don't know whether I carry the message or spread the disease, you know what I mean? You think, oh boy, I'm carrying the message, you're spreading the disease, and when you think you're spreading the disease, you're carrying the message. When we show our weakness, when my heart opens up and you see inside, I see inside of you, and we're the same. Capable of experiencing the same love, the same tenderness, the same beauty, the same goodness that a child of God wants. That's what happens. That's the message. And that gal also talked about it. The freedom not to drink today. I want to be dead. You want to be dead. And we're not. We're transformed. The woman who arrived here doesn't exist anymore. Ask Marlene. Ask me. Practice these principles in all our affairs. I haven't had any yet. But I have a date next week. And the other day I was giving a pitch out at Elmwood, and I'm telling all the women I have a date. Let us know how it turns out. Today, I'm sharing a home with a beautiful, extraordinary woman who on a daily basis teaches me how to be a woman. Teaches me, I can share things with this woman that I've never been able to before, such as, I never know how to balance my checkbook. And she's helping me go through finances and this and the bank statement and stuff like this. And she says, now let's see your checkbook. And I said, you know what I mean? I have a little ATM card if I want to know how much money I have in the bank. And she suppressed laughter. And I'm learning how to have a loving friendship. And I've never had that before. I've been a loner my whole life. I lived alone because I was so frightened of you and of me. And today that's different. Today I share a home. I share my life on a daily basis with a loving friend. I could go out to dinner with some loving AA people. There are people in this room who have known me and care as only we care in these rooms. Today, I work in an agency called Hospice of the Valley, and I get paid to be kind and compassionate. I work with terminally ill people who die in my arms at peace. Now, where do you think that strength comes from, ladies and gentlemen? You. And I reach out and I touch lives, and I touch families in the midst of their pain and turmoil of a terminal illness. And I touch them with what you touch me with every single day. I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. To those who have come before me, thank you. To those who walk beside me, thank you. And to those who come after me, with great love, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous.